Welcome to Super Typical Mega Bank. How can we disappoint you today?
Hi, I'd like to open an account.
May I pressure you into considering a pro disadvantage, high regret, impersonal, everyday inconvenient savings plan with added compound and confusion at no additional discount or apology? It's one of our top disappointers.
I feel so...
disappointed?
Yeah.
Another unsatisfied customer. Next!
If your bank makes you feel like this, it's time you talk to us. Connect First Credit Union. Bank on a brighter future.
On Professional Development is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network.
Welcome, unprofessionals, to a decidedly educational episode of Unprofessional Development. I'm your co-host, Shane Lawrence, and again, it's just me this time around. Got a bit of a different episode this time. We're on break. We're enjoying the holidays. I hope you are too, finding some time just to be with your family and hopefully relax a little bit. I know I am. So we don't have a new episode of Unprofessional Development. Me and Millie don't have one of those. But it just so happens that if you've been a long-time listener of the show, you've heard about the transition with me coming on the show. I had a podcast before now called Ed. And in the ending of that show, there actually wound up being a couple episodes I had just sitting in the can that never saw the light of day. And this is one of them. And amazingly, I feel kind of bad about this because I really feel like it should have been out there in the world, but I'm very happy that it is now. I had a conversation with Goldie Muhammad. I know she's been on Unprofessional Development before, but certainly not in this capacity. So here it is, my conversation with Goldie Muhammad.
But I gotta say, like, I've worked across different provinces in Canada, and it's like every time the teachers are just, they just take my model and they just take it to different levels. Like in Niagara yesterday, I saw some of their unit plans, blew me away. And it's really? Always like, they take it and run with it every time I work across, you know, Canada.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I was hoping you could tell me.
Well, I mean, I'm reading your stuff and it's like, you know, it's just a lot of like, I know it's good when I'm reading, I'm going, yeah, right. And like writing stuff down. It's like, oh, I like that. And there was one phrase in that piece you wrote in January. And of course now I can't remember it, but there's a couple of spots. I'm like, I just need to tweet this out right now and share it. Cause it's just like, it's just one of those bullseyes. Uh-huh. It's like something makes sense. It makes sense. I'm actually curious, like, you know, you've got this framework. I mean, this is kind of, you know, I guess in the moment it's what you're known for. But I want to kind of back up before that. I mean, what about like your own experience as a student? I mean, what was that like for you? Was it a positive, negative?
A little bit of both, depending on what school I was at. You know, I grew up in Gary, Indiana, where the kids and most of the teachers looked like me, and the curriculum, I felt like it supported me and my life. And I had really positive experiences. That was public school. For a very short time, I went to a private Islamic school, had a great experience there. Different, like I didn't see parts of myself, but I saw other parts of myself. And then I moved to the suburbs outside of Chicago, where I didn't have a teacher of color. It was like hardly few people of color in the building. And it was like, it wasn't a good experience. And you know, we make it children, you know, and I wanted to be a teacher. So I like made it a good experience, but you know, going back and training that school district later, I told them, I said, this is how you can make it better, where children don't have to make it better themselves.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, as for myself, I mean, I grew up in one school, you know, and we had, I remember in my graduating class of like 250 kids, we had one Black student.
Wow.
And yeah. Right. And I mean, I didn't have a Black teacher until I hit philosophy 101 in university.
Wow.
I did not have a teacher of color, period. No, that's not true. I had a chemistry teacher who was Chinese, but nonetheless, it was a pretty white experience. So, I mean, I don't want to sound ignorant, but at the same time, I mean, when you were in that school where you were not seeing yourself reflected, you know, in the surroundings, I mean, in what way was that a detriment for your own education?
You know, I read something recently and it says, you know, we say representation matters, but representation matters because it manifests your reality and the future of what you can be. And I think people kind of underestimate like what it can do for a person or a child. Like when you see something of yourself, whether it's the text that you read or the curriculum or like a teacher, you know, it just so happened I wanted to be a teacher. And, you know, I didn't see teachers of color or a Black woman teacher or a Black teacher. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it really helps you to manifest of like who you can become if you're that person. And it allows you to feel safer and have comfort. Like, you know, I make a joke that like I did this thing called Vipassana. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's like a 10-day silent retreat from Buddhist culture. And, you know, you're just there with a bunch of strangers and you cannot look at each other in the eye or talk for 10 days. And you're just kind of living amongst each other and you're meditating, you're eating meals together, but it's no... But on the first day of orientation, you could talk. And I just, you know, I'm like back in school, which by tray of food, and I'm like, where do I sit? And I go to like either who represents me in any kind of way, whether it's somebody with hoop earrings or dressed like me or, you know, a Black woman. We're always looking for ourselves for safety and comfort. So I think it's that. And I just think like, it allows us to just be ourselves when we see ourselves.
I noticed that actually in a lot of what you write about as well, the idea of just being able to feel seen and just even just having that sense of existence. Mm-hmm. So how did that emerge from your own experience? The idea of just being seen and having that feeling of existence? Because I mean, you write in your writing about, that, you know, there's sort of this link between being able to express oneself and having that sense of like peace and joy that you talk about. So how did that emerge from your own experience as a student?
Well, you know, and I'm glad that you feel like I'm talking in my writing, because I do want to feel like I am talking to teachers and leaders and, you know, brothers and sisters and everybody. You know, they say that like you write from two major spaces, right? The knowledge you carry from natural organic experiences, just like lived experiences. And then the knowledge that you gain from the world through like books and texts and research. Mm-hmm. And certainly I come from both of those spaces. You know, I look at those moments where I felt seen and heard and acknowledged and validated and celebrated in my school in Gary, Indiana. And I use that to say, like, this is what schools can be. If I had it, other children can have it. They do have it in many schools. And then I look at, you know, the experiences that I did not love, you know, like not seeing myself in what I read and not reading about Black women or only reading about Black people being called slaves in high school. And I look and see, like, how can we flip that? So I'm always sort of speaking from the pains, the joys, the triumphs, the struggles, because they're both real to me. And they're not just real to me, but they're real to many other children and teachers in schools today.
Yeah. I think, you know, something, the light that came on for me was the idea that, right, we often start narratives of like Indigenous people, Black people, with what has been done to them. Mm-hmm. And what's a healthier approach? I mean, you're talking about a more holistic kind of thing, but you mentioned like pains and trials. But I mean, where should one start? Where does the narrative start for students to get maybe a healthier picture of different communities?
Well, you know, it's funny, like what has been done to them, even when we tell those stories, they're not full, accurate, or complete. You know, it doesn't tell the truth. So I think people are against this starting place for many different reasons. One, you never start someone's story off of what oppressive accounts that someone else has done to them. Mm. It just, you should tell that story for sure. But it's not where the story begins, because what ends up happening is that when that's taught, let's say, for decades in schools, that becomes the story. Like that oppressive history becomes the history, the only history. Mm-hmm. And we don't know who this group of people were before, during, or after, really, at the essence of their souls and their spirits and their existence, of absent of that oppression, right? We just know that. So when we tell those stories, that we often don't tell the full truth, because there's this fear in the United States that if I tell the full truth about people who look like me, my children will feel bad for their parents, for me, for everybody, and they'll start to associate oppression with my skin color. And you should be saying, let's associate truth with your skin color. And let's teach your own children like the truth of what people have done before us, and to not perpetuate into, you know, repeat that history. Because we have, you know, massive shootings of Black people back in the day in the 1800s. We have them today because the parents refused. They just ignored the history, or they refused to teach white children, their white child, like, listen, this happened. I need to make sure that you interrupt it and you don't contribute to it. Mm-hmm. So first, that needs to be said. And where to start the history? You always start with the truth, the essence, the beauty, the genius of the group of people, you know, especially uniquely people of color who've had their stories, or any, you know, group of people who have been oppressed, or which I define as hurt, pain, or harmed. Mm-hmm. I like to start people's story off with who are they? What's the beauty of their culture, of their lives, of their actions, of everything? And what did they contribute, and what are they continuing to contribute to the world to make the world a better place? And, you know, when oppression hits them, that is a story that needs to be told in truth, like I was just saying. But I always start with the genius and joy of a group of people. I keep it that simple. And it doesn't have to be, you know, as complicated. Like if you're talking about South Africans, we don't start their stories with apartheid. Mm-hmm. Because they had full-blown, beautiful lives before colonizers came and treated them and oppressed them the way they did. I mean,
yeah.
Let's tell the fullness of history.
Right, right. And you use those words like genius and joy. And I struggle a little bit. I mean, joy, yeah, okay, got it. I mean, it's, you know, happiness, being content with one's situation. Genius, I mean, I can you flesh that one out for me a little bit? Because I... Sure. Yeah, I'm sure you've been asked this before.
So, you know, when I was reading, not just for the book, but just throughout college and after, reading about the lives of our ancestors, of Black people, that word genius came up in my mind again and again. Like, wow, how did they do it? How did they create this? How did they do this? How did they read the North Star toward navigation? Like, would I be able to go from the South to the North? You know, we're just looking at the nature and the stars as my compass. You know, I read about all the different things they did, from hair braiding maps and their reading and writing and literacy and creating languages and coded messages. It was like genius, genius, genius. See, the problem is when we hear the word genius, we typically think of one IQ test. And if you don't score high on that test, you're not considered brilliant, smart, above average.
Right.
See, those are, you know, distorted definitions of genius, and that were steeped in whiteness. And, you know, I try to disrupt language a lot. You know, words that I'm used to hearing, I try to, even the word love. You know, love, I love you. We think of romantic love. We think that, like, oh, you have to get married and your family got to look like this in order to have love. You know, I love my best friend who's a woman like I love my husband. Like, I leave notes for her. You know, we have like this romantic love too, but nobody, but people with these limited conceptions of love, they might say, oh, that's not, you're only supposed to love your husband that way, right? Or your partner that way. So I'm saying all that to say, the way I define genius is brilliance, creativity, uniqueness, what makes you smart and gifted in your own way. I have met children who can read my facial, like they know if I'm sad, if I'm grieving, I don't even say anything. Like they have this genius gift of reading my face and reading the world. As a kid, I can double dutch, you know, have you, you know, what it means to double dutch?
Yeah, like the two skipping
ropes. Yeah, the two ropes, right? Yeah,
that one escaped me. I mean,
and there's a lot of like, do you know how to double dutch?
No, I tried, but never could quite get it.
And so double dutch, you know, I could double dutch and I can do all kind of steps and you know how much, you know, mathematics and movement and ability that takes. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of like looked at geniuses. You either have it or you're not. You're either a genius or you're not a genius. But what happens if we're all geniuses? Like if we all have creative gifts, okay, you cannot double dutch, but you can create podcasts and make them. That's genius. Like we look at the things that requires literacies and talents and gifts. And then if we can do it and create it and put something into the world, that's better. That's how I define genius.
So then in this kind of a view, is that, does that mean like genius is kind of innate? Like we've all got it. It just needs to be cultivated, or is it something we can bestow on our students? How does that work?
Maybe it's innate. Maybe it's learned. I don't know if I just was born learning how to double dutch or how to do it. Be either. It's developed, it's cultivated, right? Like over time to be better.
Right.
And I'm sure there are things that we lose, you know, sense of, and then we pick up other things. The point of all of this is that every child carries something.
Yeah.
That's beautiful and brilliant that they know and that they can do. And we need to recognize it and celebrate it and affirm it and use it to teach them more excellently. That's the whole point.
So, okay. It's like identifying students' strengths and skills and then just helping them to grow those things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Their talents. Yep. All of that.
Right. Okay. And then the other half of this is joy. I mean, you talk about joy being accessed through basically elevating our students, right? Looking higher, looking above, experiencing things that are great, for lack of a better word. And then that kind of elevates to joy. Is that basic? Am I getting that right?
Yeah. And if I can add, you know, joy is something more than just having fun and celebratory. It's teaching students to know, experience, and identify beauty in the world. Mm-hmm. And it might be beauty in humanity. It might be beauty in the earth, like nature, flowers, art, music. Joy, you know, and in my next book, I talk a little bit more about joy. But, you know, I found for the ancestors that I've been studying that joy was connected to freedom and solutions to making humanity better. That's joy. When you're working toward making that's joy. That's personal fulfillment. Joy can be when you do something that's beneficial to your own life or to the life of others. That's joy. So joy also has this extended view from just like having fun. Although, you know, having fun is important.
Yeah.
Especially in schools. But, you know, extending it more.
I like that. I like that a lot. How? Okay. Here's the thing. I mean, you start studying education. You know, you're diving into presumably a lot of different writers. Mm-hmm. Joy seems like a strange connection to make. I mean, when we study education, we talk about skills. We talk about, you know, competencies. How did you wind up through your studies arriving at joy? Like, how did that happen?
So, you know, my research started, I don't know, about 12, 15 years ago, particularly with this model, mm-hmm. where it was really clear. So I write about joy and love in cultivating genius, but it wasn't a fifth pursuit, right? And, you know, I kind of assumed that teachers were teaching about beauty and love and all these things. And that wasn't really the case always. And joy was a thing I found that was really explicitly tied to like arts programs or elementary. And then it sort of faded a little bit, or like high school teachers would tell me like, no, we don't do joy, or, you know, we don't do that. That's like the younger kids. I said, that's like saying I don't do joy as an adult. So, yeah. You know, the pandemic hit and, you know, we were all inside and teachers were struggling to adjust, you know, students were struggling to adjust. We all were. not just to the technology, but to a lot in our lives. We had to be still. And then it was like this thing that was happening that people weren't really valuing teachers and no understanding what they were doing and everything. I mean, you're talking about kindergarten on Zoom, a whole class.
Yep, I had a kid in kindergarten. Right. That time.
And then we had, you know, racial uprisings in the summer.
Yeah.
And I said, listen, you know, joy just kind of like the need for it kept coming center to my work, to my mind. So I went back into the documents and I was more explicit about like, yeah, this was joy. This was joy. This was joy. And so maybe if it's a fifth pursuit, we're a little bit more intentional about it. You know, that's one thing the pandemic taught me, to be more intentional about joy, about humanity and making it better. I mean, some folks came out the pandemic and they returned the same way they left. They're rude sometimes in the lines, like even in the grocery store, I'm like, really, did you learn anything from the pandemic to be more patient? Like, that's a small example.
Yeah.
But seriously, like folks were just kind of, they went back to the same ways. And so I said, we need something to remind us because teachers need joy. We were losing teachers in the field. So there's a lot of different reasons of why that became a prominent and a final pursuit. And I like to argue that the whole purpose of education, it should be for self-fulfillment and joy. If children are not experiencing the beauty of the world and joy, what are we doing? Are we just preparing them for tests and for careers that they're going to be unhappy with as adults? I don't know. Like, you got to teach them to smile, to have fulfillment, the essence. I got to tell you, you know, especially in the United States, we have a high number of mental health issues. We have a high number of suicides. We have a high number of like mass killings. Something's not working. And I'm not saying like, let's fix the schools and then all the problems will be solved, because we know there's so many pieces to the puzzle. But we can do different. We can do a different type of pedagogy in schools where it's a loving, centered orientation.
I love that. I think that's beautiful. I mean, you mentioned earlier just, you know, how you love your friend and you love your husband. And about 10 years ago, I decided I'm just going to start telling my kids that I love them. And it's always funny when I do it the first time, because especially a lot of the guys are like, ah, Mr. Lawrence, gross. I'm like, no, I don't want to date you. I just love you. You know, and that's,
yeah,
and
oh, yes.
Yeah, I teach like grade 7, you know, and
I was thinking your regular kids. I'm like, okay.
Oh, no, I told them, no, they're down with dad loving them. That's all good.
Okay.
No, my students.
Yeah. And I tell my college students, and one student, she was a doc student. She says, you're the first professor who ever told me. It was the first day. I was like, thank you. Good to see you. See you next week. I love you all. It was like one of those. She was like, she said, many years later, you're the first teacher I've had that said, I love you. And mm-hmm. It meant something to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you keep saying it, you know, I mean, in my classes, when I keep saying it, eventually, you know, I got the hockey, you know, the kids playing hockey, call them like, I love you, Mr. Lawrence. I'm like, yeah, it's awesome. You know? So, right. It matters. It matters to them, you know?
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, crumb. Where was I going with this?
Well, we're talking about joy last.
Yeah. Yeah. So is this the solution? I mean, is it just this simple that we educate people well and then we can find access to joy? Is it that simple?
I mean, nothing beautiful and important is simple. Education is very complex. The system of education is very complex, but there are parts that I like to feel is simple. Like,
yeah,
the way we organize curriculum and pedagogy is should be simple. Like, mm-hmm. when I create curriculum, it feels simple to me. It's complex,
yeah,
but it feels like there's ease. And yeah, it's simple. These five things can help a child. But see, the issue is there are so many factors that impact the development of a human. And that, I mean, that's what we're really talking about, how a human develops. I mean, ultimately. And so, you know, education is so broad. Schooled education is part of it, right? You have home, communities, you know, religious institutions, you have healthcare, you have policies, you have mandates and laws. I mean, you have histories and you have genetics. I mean, all these things play a part. But see, when it comes to the school of education, like the schooling and education, we have the history we have. We cannot change that. But what we can change is how we educate children today. We can change, you know, the state standards, the how, what we expect of children. That can be written overnight. We have so much genius in the world that we can write better standards. We can change. And now, you know, we write them, we get them approved, mandate. You see how fast these laws go from a, you know, like a draft to being now all of a sudden this is a mandate, like we have to follow it. Why can't we do that in schools? We can change the criteria in which we select curriculum and write curriculum. That can be changed. To me, that feels simple. Mm-hmm. Number three, we can change assessments. People think assessments are so hard to stop or change, like state standardized tests. We can change those. Again, I want to remind everyone of the brilliance we have. You get minds in the same room. Okay, you hit this topic, you hit this topic. Okay, you're an expert here. We can do that. We can change teacher evaluations and what we expect of teachers to do. We can write out those guidelines. The teacher evaluation is a few pages. Yep, we can edit that. Mm-hmm. And we can change teacher preparation programs. We have the power. Professors and administrators have the power to do that. So like when I look at it in chunks of the system, yeah, it does feel simple. And if you know, my work is looking at these five aspects, joy included, right, to set learning assessments and objectives around and to teach students to know themselves, to know the skills, to know new knowledge, to know the world and how to make the world better and to know joy. When I say it out loud, people say to me, you make it sound simple. And in many ways, it can be. If we don't have all this other stuff of hate and ignorance getting in the way, it can be simple.
It sounds like ultimately what it boils down to is just a change in our approach, in our mindset. It doesn't, like you say, the simplicity of it is because it's just like, hey, let's just look at it from another point of view. Let's just figure out this. Yeah.
You said it, mindset. But, you know, mindsets are hard to change. You know, it depends on people's, you know, how they go. I mean, there's some people I meet, they're like, girl, I'm 62. I'm not going to change. But you can. If you chose, you know, if that's your mindset. So mindset is, I mean, we know this. I mean, that's what I learned from the Vipassana Institute in meditating for 13 hours. It was really difficult.
Yeah.
But the power of the mind and what can happen, you know, so you're absolutely right. It's the mind, and the mind is very powerful. If only we are open enough to learn and to change our thinking.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know we're running out of time here, but can I ask you one more thing before we go?
Sure.
What is it that gives you joy?
There are lots of things. It is, you know, it is seeing the best in humanity being played out in my observations and my view. You know, it's Black people give me joy, the creativity, the beauty of us. Islam gives me joy. My family, my husband and partner, and daughter and friends and people who, you know, become my family, they give me joy. You know, it's the possibility of a better tomorrow. And when I see it, I know like, okay, this is real. This is my new reality. It's kind of like the representation. Mm-hmm. You know, when I see teachers, like I'm joyful when I'm around teachers, like when I'm in a session with them and we're sharing ideas and I'm just so happy being around them and the beauty of it. So, you know, just being on the earth, watching it grow, the natural things of the earth.
Yeah.
You know, like the flowers and the, you know, not so much of like the how we can make the earth work bad, but, you know, all the beautiful things bring me joy.
Well, Golda, thank you. No, you honestly have brought me joy. This is something, as an aside, that I've been struggling with as a teacher, primarily in the arts, and wondering, why am I teaching this stuff? And always thinking that it's about beauty, but I've never felt like beauty's enough, but this is some good validation.
It's ask teachers, out of all the things in the world that you haven't taught yet, what would you teach? What history, what new history would you teach? Would it be the history of double Dutch or, you know, a hockey, like the mathematics of hockey, like whatever it is, I think like that's a good starting place for teachers in the classrooms. Like teach something that sets your soul on fire, that ignites your heart. That's what joy is.
Mm-hmm. And it spreads.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Goldie, thanks a lot.
Thank you. This was joy.
It was. If people want to get more joy, if they want to get in touch with you, I mean, how can they do that?
Well, I'm on Twitter, Goldie M, GHOLDYM. That's the same for Instagram. And I'm also, you know, my next book will be out on unearthing joy.
Nice. Appropriate.
So how do we get to joy, particularly as like a follow-up to Cultivating Genius? I'm also at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And always looking for like great students who I can study with and share genius with too. If folks can handle the cold, we would love to have you in Chicago. Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
Hey, Mila, guess what?
What, Shay? Not chicken butt, I guess. As we always say down here.
My 8-year-old daughter has informed me it is never going to be chicken butt.
No.
No, it's not. It's not. I try every time, though. But listen, we got another ad.
Oh, cool. I love ads.
Yeah, me too. Ads are the best.
They are.
So our episode.
This country was built on ads. Both of our countries were built on ads. Go ahead.
Absolutely. You may have heard of them. Now, our episode is brought to our listeners by the Alberta Blue Cross.
Awesome. I love Alberta Blue Cross.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my favorite Blue Crosses.
Yeah, Blue Crosses are the best. Absolutely.
They are. Hey, are
you a business?
I mean, the Red Cross is okay, but Blue Cross is obviously greater than Red Cross. Go ahead.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't want to start a fight, but listen, hey, are you a business owner?
Kind of. I have a podcast business.
Yeah, and you know that life as a business owner can be hectic.
It's really hectic. It's crazy.
That's right.
Employees and the payroll and all this kind of stuff.
Exactly right. You know what's great, though, is the Alberta Blue Cross, they understand that.
Good.
They do, because they know that you don't have a lot of time for things like, you know, health insurance. So they offer flexible health and dental and life and disability coverage for your employees.
I love the idea of flexible.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. And for all your employees.
Excellent.
All of them here at Unprofessional Development Incorporated.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's right.
Can we keep Tedisco as an employee, even though he's left the podcast?
Well, I think he would appreciate the services offered by Alberta Blue Cross.
Excellent.
Because you can let your staff enroll and manage their coverage at any time and on any device.
So not just once a year?
No, just anytime.
Cool.
On any device. I mean, if their toaster supports it, you know, if you got a Bluetooth toaster, you can probably manage your extended health care.
That would be awesome.
On a toaster. That's right. That'd be great.
Yeah.
So it makes life easier for them, and it makes it easier for you. So I want to encourage you. Can I encourage you?
I want to be encouraged, yes.
All right. Well, I'm going to tell you, you've got this.
Okay.
When it comes to group coverage for your small business.
So is there something I just need to click on, or what do I need to do? I mean, I don't have a Bluetooth toaster. What do I do?
What do you do? You're going to go to ab.bluecross.ca.
Oh, that's easy. Okay.
Super easy.
Yes.
All right.